Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Victoria James, author of Wine Girl: The Obstacles, Humiliations, and Triumphs of America's Youngest Sommelier. It was published in March by Echo. Victoria's first book, by the way, was Think Pink, which is about rosé, a sometimes maligned wine that she kind of reinvents for us in many ways. But this book is more, well, I'll get to it in a minute. Victoria's pedigree is she's the youngest, as the title says, sommelier in the country, was at the time. By the way, she has a great blog called Get Your Grape On. On YouTube, there's this show called 750 Super Tasters, which is also excellent too. She runs the beverage program at GOAT, which she controls, is in charge of over 1,200 wines, cocktails, even the water. She spent, at her young age, 2 years at Oriel, 2 years at Maria, helped open Morini, and the one Michelin star restaurant Peora, and now, as I say, she works at GOAT. The book is amazing in the sense that it tells a story that is both memoir, autobiography, kind of a wine primer, motivational in a great sense, and empowering for women. So, in addition to the things I've already said, and not to go on too long, Victoria's been named in Zagat's 30 Under 30, Wine Enthusiast 40 Under 40. I suppose I get to some 70 Under 70 program. She's also been on the Forbes 10 Top 10 Innovators in Wine and Spirits as well. So, Victoria, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So, as I said in the beginning, it's kind of a book about transformation of you and an industry, and it's kind of part memoir. It's an autobiography in a way. It's a book about motivation. It's a book about empowerment. And again, it's a book about the love of wine. And for people who drink it, don't know much about it, and you tell us a lot about it. So, since I went over all the things you do, what have you been doing all cooped up for this past month? Especially since you do more in a day than I do in a week.
Well, we're very fortunate here at Cote Korean Steakhouse in the Flatiron District of Manhattan, in that we were able to transition to delivery. So we are delivering wine, cocktails, and food via the Caviar app and pickup. And we've seen enough success to be able to keep us afloat during these hard times. And it's, they're long 16-hour days, 7 days a week. But we have a great team here of chefs and partners and managers. And I'm peeling eggs and running deliveries to houses. It's an interesting time, but it's giving us a lot of hope.
Yeah, and it will, as you've heard over and over again, it will change everything. But how do you work it with the wines? So you just deliver a bottle. What happens to the people who used to want wines by glass and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So we're now allowed to deliver wine directly to our guests, which was something that was previously illegal, but it has alleviated us quite a bit financially. And persons at home here finding are not really drinking a glass of wine anymore at dinner during the pandemic. We're selling not just bottles, we're selling magnums directly to people. And it's good for up to a week in the fridge. So persons are having a glass or two a night. And then, it's a nice way to kind of still connect with our consumers. And I write personal tasting notes for each bottle. So it's different, but it's lovely.
Yeah, it really is an amazing time. As you may know, I have an independent bookstore, and we've done the same things. drop shipping things that we never thought we would have been able to do before. And all of a sudden you come up with these profit centers that you didn't even know had the potential to exist.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. It's a whole new business model we had to come up with overnight.
Yeah, necessity. We're trying to sell your book, so let's go back to that. So if you go back to necessity, and let's get rid of the hard stuff first, because your history with your parents, your history with your extended family, the troubles you had growing up, those are all raw. And in many of the interviews I've seen, people will say, what was the most difficult part about writing this? And there's some very traumatic parts, and you expose yourself essentially completely to the world. How do you do that?
Well, when I was first writing the book, it was sort of my own personal form of therapy. I've always kept journals and diaries, and it was originally just for me to kind of work through a lot of these traumatic events. But eventually I realized that this might be something that could help a lot of other young women, a lot of people in general. And it didn't really hit me until I was reading the audiobook, and I was like, wow, I can't believe I am this honest and raw, and it's a really scary thing. But since the book has come out, I've received now over 500 messages from women and men all over the world who said that by sharing my story, it gave them the courage to face their own trauma and past experiences of sexism and abuse and misogyny, and work through them and empower others to do the same. And that's the whole reason I wrote the book and published it, was so that it could give other people hope and let them know that they're not alone, and together we can champion for social justice and change.
We'll get to it in more detail, but one example that I thought was really good, because it's sometimes something that me as an old white guy can find myself doing, is talk about those guys that you call the cowboys, because what they do is kind of insidious. You can't really point a finger at them exactly, but everyone knows who they are. That was a great section.
Yeah, the Corkage Cowboys. So these were a specific group of men that would come into one of the Michelin-starred restaurants I worked in, and they would bring large quantities of their own wine from their cellars. And certainly I'm no stranger to bringing corkage into restaurants. I think a lot of people do it at times, special bottles, things you want to share. I think that there's a lot of beauty to that. However, there's a difference between bringing in your own bottles and bringing in 20 of your own bottles and blending the line between servitude and is not appropriate. And they would bring in, women they had hired and embarrass them in front of everyone. And I remember this one time, one of the women they brought in, she was so hungry and she went to go reach for a bread roll on the table, and he slapped it out of her hand and said, "No, you do not get to eat." And it's just this horrible culture that is propagated, I don't know why, in many different restaurants, and I wanted to call attention to it.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you read the stories, whether it's about obviously Harvey Weinstein or Epstein or anybody, sometimes you lose sight of the fact, because you'll say something like, oh, why didn't she say something? Or why didn't she just scream? Or why didn't she just walk out of the room? And I have to admit that sometimes I thought that too. But then after reading your book, I realized, wait a minute, you really don't have a choice. And you make that very clear. Like, what would you possibly have done? First of all, you would have lost your job. You probably never would have gotten another job. So,
right.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about it. It's the first time it really became clear to me that you actually do not have a choice.
Yeah, and I think that the people who are at the top and are, again, propagating this culture know that they have this power over these young women and that they don't have a choice. And they often use their position of power to abuse their status and other persons. And it really needs to end.
When you look back, and you look back, even if you look back at your book and kind of dog-ear the pages where you found yourself in a situation where you didn't say something, or like in the bedroom with that guy on the trip to South America, or the guy at the restaurant that hung out at the counter reading the book, and you didn't say anything, do you ever look back at that and say, shouldn't I have taken the keys that I had between my fingers and punched him in the eye with it or anything like that? Do you feel, do you ever do that?
Of course. I mean, you know, whenever you look back at trauma, and especially with sexual abuse and women, you always think, first and foremost, our society tells us it must have been your fault. You must have done something wrong. You must have been asking for it. And then second, you think, what if I just said something? What if I just spoke up? What if I attacked him back? Would I be better off? What if I told someone after the attack? What if I asked for help? And of course, those weren't things that I felt at the time, because I was so isolated and I had no one to go to. And everyone around me kept repeating that the customer's always right, and they would call me wine girl as a joke, and no one took me seriously. Everyone was constantly belittling and sexualizing me. And I never want women who I now mentor and look after at my restaurant to feel that way. I want them to feel empowered to say to guests at the table, hey, please don't call me that. Or if it ever crosses the line into abuse or harassment, to find me and we'll kick them out of the restaurant right away. I think that you have to build those safety systems and that trust, because we can ask ourselves, what if I said something? But I don't know if I would have been better off without a support system. And so we need to start building that.
And it's funny, I know you've been to, and there's so many interesting characters in the book, like Sean Muldoon and the Dead Rabbit, which is a wonderful place that I love. But there's tons of people in there. But it seems like, even though there were great people and great restaurants, it seems like you really didn't find exactly what you're just describing until you went to Goat. That seems like it was like finally finding the right place.
Right. And I think that the message I wanted to leave people with was, when I met Simon Kim at his first restaurant, Peora, and now his next restaurant, Coat, is that there are healthy communities within the hospitality world. We just have to find them or build them. And meeting Simon finally gave me the courage to stand up for myself. And it was a healthy place. It was, you know, something I hadn't experienced the last 10, 15 years of my career. So I encourage people to find and seek out those healthy relationships and build on them.
How can you have a 15-year career? You're only 30.
Well, as you remember in the book, I started in restaurants when I was 13.
That's true. Well, you can call the greasy spoon a career. You're right.
Well, there's a lot of, I mean, I think during this COVID crisis too, we're seeing that a lot of the most susceptible and vulnerable people in our community are these restaurant workers, everyone from those who work at diners to fine dining restaurants. No one's immune.
Yeah, I know. And I feel so sorry for the kids at, say, Chick-fil-A. They got like 300 people driving by them every single day within 6 feet. It just, yeah. Wow. It just seems silly. The whole thing seems silly. But yeah. Anyway, so going back to the book again and the hard parts. So your father and mother are treated, obviously, I'm not going to say harshly, but you don't paint a beautiful portrait of them. Yet at the very end of the book, there seems to be a type of reconciliation. I assume they both have read it, and I assume you've talked about it with them.
Yeah, and my mother especially was very instrumental in helping me, you know, recall a lot of the events in my life, along with my brother and sister. They helped me with the manuscript, and, you know, no one's soul memories are completely accurate. So it was really important for me to have both family and colleagues read over the manuscript so that everything was accurate. My mother provided photos as well. You know, I think there was so much more I could have said about my parents and their own story, but I tried to be as fair as possible, which is a hard thing to do, but I tried to only include stories that would pertain to my own narrative or restaurants. And I mean, I think that the end I wanted to include, because I think when we're children, we, you know, we only have our parents and we blame them for maybe a lot of our shortcomings or a lot of our trauma. And I think that with age comes a certain amount of distance and understanding, and, you know, it's all about forgiveness and moving on. And so you know, I love them very much, despite a lot of things that happened during my childhood. And I think I'm very grateful for them and all their help with the book.
Yeah, and the opposite side of the coin is that the relationships that you described with Tim and Laura and your second, is it Angela?
Angela, yes.
Yeah, those all seem to be like wonderful, loving, caring, nurturing relationships from beginning on. And they're very well described, and they seem like wonderful people.
They are wonderful people. Yes. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, we had to make the best with what we were given. And I think it made them stronger and more resilient.
I was really interested that you were reading Italo Calvino, because he's like my favorite author of all time.
Oh, yeah, I love him. Yeah, that was a great book to kind of get me out of the wine world and into the real world.
Yeah, we're talking about The Baron and the Trees, which is one of my favorite books. And as I said, in my bookstore, I have all of his books just lined up and try to get everyone to read every single one of them. So what's it like having to handle... You talk a lot about distributors and how they're pushy and push you and threaten you almost. And what you've tried to do at Cote is not follow that same paradigm. But somehow it seems almost like, and I guess I'm stretching it a little bit, when the mafia comes into a pizza parlor and says, hey, you need to buy these boxes. And you go, no, I want to buy these boxes. And they go, no, you have to buy these boxes. How do you get out of that?
Yeah, I mean, it is similar to the mafia in some ways, I suppose. But... you know, I think that the most important thing for me was building a wine program with integrity and only purchasing from wine growers I've personally met and know how they make the wine, and to be able to offer that to our guests. And there's a lot of pay to play in the wine industry. So you really have to be careful as a buyer not to get threatened or bullied into buying certain things, but also not to be, you know, incentivized in certain ways. But there are a lot of great people in the wine world. After all, I do marry a wine salesman as well.
Oh, that's true. Sorry.
So, you know, there are certainly, you know, not everyone who sells wine has the worst in mind. There are a lot of great people in this world, but certainly there is that dark side that exists. And I think that we should talk about it more.
Well, even in that aspect, with regard to the instructor and with regard to other programs, you do talk about how people use the ability to elevate you to take advantage of you as well. Not necessarily in the previous sexual sense we were taking, but in the profit-making sense. So you do discuss it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the problem with a lot of these schools for wine and certification programs, there's hundreds that exist out there, but there's no checks and balances. So there's a lot of potential for abuse. And I just really wanted to learn about wine. And I found that myself and many of my colleagues described these really unhealthy power plays and abuse of power. And so that's also one of the reasons I decided to start the 501c3 nonprofit with two other female sommeliers to create a healthy environment in which, you know, women and persons of color aren't belittled or sexualized and can learn and bring these unique viewpoints to the table.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the organization you've set up and how it is so inclusive, because otherwise the community is not inclusive at all, apparently, until you kind of broke the ice and just a few other women as well. So what does the organization attempt to do?
Yeah, so the organization is called Wine Empowered, and we offer tuition-free wine classes to women and persons of color in the hospitality industry. We're in our inaugural class now of 23 students who are curious and whip smart. And of course, you know, the biggest barrier to growth in the industry is education. So we provide it for free to persons that might not have had that opportunity before. But what a lot of these students are saying is that they love the class, of course, because they're learning about wine, but also because it's a community where they feel heard. And, you know, the wine world is an old boys club, and our group of wine empowered students, it's a breath of fresh air. And we honestly believe that the more unique viewpoints that are brought to the table, the more innovation that can occur. And I think that a lot of innovation should be occurring right now in the wine world, and it's just not, because it's too homogenized. So our goal is to go to the margins of the wine society and bring the people who are on the margins in.
Yeah, it's so funny how it's such a microcosm of what's happening. The fact that all three people who might be president of the country are in their late 70s, it's, you know, and all white, it's very, and all men. It's a very, and the other thing that's really interesting about the book is, and you kind of weave back and forth the way you wanted things to be, like you wanted to get the pins that showed you as being a master. You liked the etiquette of it, the kabuki theater aspect of opening the bottle and smelling the cork and the taste to the customer. But then when you take a place like Cabaret and Antoine, it's the complete opposite, which is, I love that. But which do you like better, and is there a middle ground?
Yeah, I think that the beauty of the wine world is that there are so many great experiences you can have that are fantastic. And there was this one experience I described in the book where I'm in the south of France at this small little restaurant called Cabaret with Antoine Delmas. And it's the opposite of a Michelin-starred restaurant with fancy tablecloths. He's dropping food on the floor. He's dancing. He's smoking cigarettes. At one point, he pulls down his pants and flashes us in the dining room. And it's this insane night that sort of juxtaposes all of the fine dining restaurants I grew up in. And, I think that wine should be fun at the end of the day. It shouldn't be taken too seriously. And there is a certain beauty to these centuries of tradition of wine service that I find very beautiful. And I think as a young sommelier, it was very important for me to pay homage to this. But that's not the point of wine. And I don't think that people should let that stifle their creativity or their service with guests. The most important thing is making that connection. And that's what food and wine is all about, bringing people together. And if you miss that with your wine service, you're not a very good sommelier.
It's interesting because, when you started out and you didn't know anything, you took lots and lots of notes. But the word notes in the wine world connotes, no pun intended, two different things. Yes, you're taking notes and you're writing down what you need to know as fast as you possibly can, especially when you were younger. But then, like if you look at or talk to somebody or look at one of those 750 or your 750 thing, and then they put the columns of what you've done with regard to the nose and the palate and the structure. This is really hard to do, but describe what those notes actually are, because there's somebody who's not going to understand when you say notes of mulberry and ash and new fruit and white flowers versus yellow flowers.
Yeah. I remember when I was first learning about wine and I was listening to all these sommeliers describe all of these berries they found in the wine. Oh, it's like blackberries and cherries and cassis. And I thought to myself, are there actually blackberries in this wine? I don't understand. I thought wine was made from grapes. But it's a very common thing. A lot of people, when you first smell wine, you're not taught this terminology. And so you have to study it and it becomes a certain skill set. And the whole reason to describe the nuances you're getting from the wine, the aromas and the structure, the acidity, the alcohol, the tannins, et cetera. The whole point of doing this is to train your palate, not to do a fun parlor trick, but so that you can assess wine properly and you can become a better buyer, and you know what's good and what's not, and you know what's typical and atypical, and use it as a skill to serve guests.
Yeah, the other funny thing is the way to take something as simplistic as most people thinking, okay, I'm having a steak, I'll have a Cabernet, I'll have a red wine, or I'm having fish, so I'll have a Chardonnay or another white wine, and then you'll have sommeliers will say, drink whatever you like is fine. Just whatever you like to drink. But there also is a chemical reason for that combination, correct?
Totally. I mean, the whole reason people say red wine goes with red meat, white wine goes with fish, is because there's a chemical comp, there's tannins in red wine. And when you mix that with fish, it gives off this really irony, oily taste, and is quite unpleasant. And this happens all the time. You know, wine's made up of chemicals, food is as well. And when a lot of these have interactions, they can be quite not nice. But, you know, everyone's palate is different as well. So I think the job of the sommelier is, you know, to recommend what would make the food taste best. But at the end of the day, you know, people should drink what they enjoy. But I will say that the world of wine is so exciting and so beautiful, and there's so many things to discover. So the more adventurous you are as a drinker, I honestly think the better wine experience you'll have.
What about the fact that, like, to use a kind of silly analogy, suppose I have a really, really, really fast computer, and for some reason my website is loading really slowly, but it's because the web hosting of that site is a really slow server. So you're only going to be as fast as the slowest connection. So you must have an incredible palate. But then the majority of your customers, definitely including me, I don't have, first of all, I'm older, so I don't have as good a palate as I did when I did have a good palate. So how do you figure out, knowing that you, not as a compliment, but that you have an exquisite sense of all of these undertones, almost in a symphonic sense. It's very musical. How do you tone that down, no pun intended again, for a customer who just says, I want something like this?
Yeah, I'm, you know, it's certainly a different skill set to be able to taste all these different things and then to be able to translate to the guests and not come off as a complete snob or not be able to give them something they'd like. So, you know, you're almost like a detective. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how a sommelier should constantly be scanning their guests for clues and trying to find ways to better serve them. So you have to figure out what bottle of wine to recommend, and usually under 30 seconds. And for us at Coat, we have 1,200 wines on our list. So that's a lot in a very short period of time. And oftentimes guests will just say, I want a red wine. It's hard to lower down. So you really have to pay attention to many different clues, what they're drinking beforehand, what cocktails, sparkling water or still water. You know, there's also a whole chapter in the book where I go into the detective work that the restaurant and reservations team does beforehand, which many people don't know. So there's a lot that goes into it. But at the end of the day, if you're usually just honest with guests and, you know, you use deference and just try and genuinely help them, people are quite responsive and usually will be a bit more adventurous.
Yeah, that was fascinating how, especially in a Michelin starter restaurant, that there is so much Google work done prior to the patron's arrival to make those determinations. And then, as you said, looking at their clothes, looking at the type of watch, looking at the purse, all those kinds of things. And granted, it does bottom down to profit, but it was still fascinating and very interesting to read about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also isn't necessarily profit. I think that some restaurants do believe that, and I think that's a bit short-sighted of them, because it's really about giving the guest the best experience. And so if a sommelier tries to gouge you with the most expensive bottle of wine they can possibly manage to squeeze out of you, it's really short-sighted, because they'll probably never come back to that restaurant. So I always tell my sommelier team here to figure out what the price point is of the guest, but always go a little bit below it. We'd rather them come back 10, 20 times than just once.
Oh, yeah. And you actually come up with some really innovative techniques. First of all, buying wine in magnums was one of the ones that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And also opening bottles and allowing the patrons to not drink the entire bottle and then serving the remainder by glass. Whoever heard of things like that? Did you invent them?
No, I did not invent that. I think the first time I heard about it was they were doing it at a restaurant called Charlie Bird in New York. I don't know if they still do it, but I thought it was pretty interesting. They did it for a few selections on their list, not everything. And if you have a program that's small enough, as we did at Peora, it works quite well. And, you know, if you have a lot of friends who you've been serving wine to for a few years, which at that point I did, they trust you and you can text them, come in and drink this amazing bottle. We're serving it by the glass. And now at Coach, we do Magnum Mondays. So every Monday we open a special Magnum and serve it at cost. So guests can really enjoy these rare bottles they wouldn't have otherwise. And then all of our by the glass wines are also bottled in Magnum just for us because the wine inside stays fresher for longer. So it tastes better. And it's our little way of telling our guests we care about them and we want to give them the best product we can.
Talk a little bit about the work that, remember when you had to, which restaurant was it that had the most amazing collection? It was four floors of different cellars.
Oh, Harry's at Hanover Square.
Yeah, that was an amazing job that you did. And that must have been that was an education itself, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, looking back now, I realize how invaluable that experience was to work in this wine cellar with wine, you know, dating back a century. And that's an experience I think a lot of young sommeliers don't get. And the problem with that is they don't have a classically trained palate. They don't know what Bordeaux or Burgundy or old Cabernet tastes like from the 60s and 70s and 80s, and be able to talk about vintage variation in depth and producer knowledge. And because I had this rare experience to work as a cellar rat for free, I tasted these incredible bottles and I was able to ask the owner, Harry Poulikakos, about these stories and, you know, understand the currency of wine and how it shifts and how things go in and out of vogue, et cetera. So, you know, I really encourage a lot of young sommeliers to try and get that experience, you know, work as a cellar rat somewhere and just learn and touch these bottles and to taste these wines is an incredible education.
What about the experience you had, especially at the back bar, when you were learning how to make cocktails perfectly and all that? How does that help, if it does, in your current position or when you became sommelier?
Well, it certainly comes in handy now. I'm not bartending as much, but right now at the restaurant, we're doing cocktails to go and I'm the only beverage person here. So I'm making cocktails for delivery service around Manhattan. So definitely comes in handy. But, you know, it's really important as well, I think, if you're moving up in the beverage world to understand all of the roles. And so hiring now, you know, when we opened Coat, we had to hire a team of a dozen bartenders and barbacks and to be able to have the skill set to know what goes into their job and to build a cocktail program. It's hard to do that without understanding what the role looks like. So I'm very grateful to have trained and worked as a bartender here in New York. I think it gives you a lot more empathy for those working for you.
You know, it's interesting that, as I said earlier, the book has so many different characters, and it's so nice that you develop so many wonderful relationships with so many people in such a great city. But some of them were pains in the butt, and some of them were mean. And I know you've changed some of the names. Did you leave any of the really mean people's names real just so that they would know you hated them?
No, I don't hate anyone. I mean, even people that were quite horrible to me, I think that, you know, hate is something that eats away at someone, and I don't want that.
I don't really mean hate. I'm just thinking, I'm thinking of the one woman who said, Victoria, stop. Just stop.
Yeah. No, I changed her name. I mean, I think the point of the book was not calling out specific people. It was to change the whole culture, you know, and I think that and all these letters I've gotten from other women and men from around the world, so many things they've – one of the biggest things they've said is that I know someone just like this Regina character. I know someone just like this Renard character. It allows someone else to put their own narrative into mine and not worry about this call-out culture.
How did you start to learn how important it was? Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. Foraging. How do you forage in New York City?
Well, you can definitely learn to forage in New York City. There are quite a few native species that are very interesting. But I don't recommend eating a lot of the Manhattan flora or fauna. I would say how I learned to forage was with a guy named Evan, who forages for a lot of Manhattan-based fine dining restaurants, and he forages in eastern Pennsylvania, as well as Vermont and upstate New York. And so I would go when I was working at Marea with him on the weekends, and he would show me all these different species and plants. And it's a short drive outside of the city. So I highly encourage everyone to get outside of the world of fine dining for a bit and get into the natural world. It certainly gives you a better perspective on life.
Yeah, and it gives you at least 6 feet of space between the next person.
Yes.
Well, so what are you going to do now? Do you see yourself? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? Which is a silly interviewer question.
Well, you know, right now it's hard to predict what's going to happen to the world of restaurants with this COVID-19. I honestly think a lot of my friends are just trying to stay afloat right now. And so I highly encourage anyone who can afford to do so to please support their local restaurants and order delivery, because otherwise we're going to return to a world without restaurants, just maybe Chick-fil-A. That's it. So, you know, that's really important. And if we're allowed to do so and stay afloat, we are opening Cote Miami this year. Hopefully we signed the lease last year, and we're starting construction. So after that, we're opening a few more coats, hopefully. And I'm writing more, and this nonprofit, Wine Empowered, I hope it grows and expands and the wine world becomes more inclusive. My main goal is to make the hospitality world a really happy, healthy place. And it is, but we have some work to do still.
Well, I can't think of a better person to do it than you. And your story was great. And like I said, I love the idea that starting it out thinking it was a memoir and then realizing it was your entire life and then realizing how motivational it was even for me and empowering even for me, but then realizing this is a book about wine and I love wine and I learned so much about it. But for a time you forget, wait a minute, and then all of a sudden you're talking about all the stuff that I really wanted to know about. So it was a really good combination of things, more so than I found in many authors. So thank you very much for writing the book.
Thank you. I really appreciate your kind words.
Okay. We were talking with Victoria James, author of Wine Girl, The Obstacles, Humiliations, and Triumphs of America's Youngest Sommelier. So I can't wait to go to the restaurant in New York that she now is the beverage manager for. It's called Cote, C-O-T-E. She's worked with some, if you look at back at the interview, or at the summary of this that I post along on the podcast at Podomatic or at iTunes, you will see the places she's worked at. Or you can also look her up online on YouTube. Victoria James is her name, Wine Girl. There's some really good YouTube videos of her tasting wine and talking about it. So as always, thanks for being here today. And I look forward to you having me back here next week and the weeks after. Another one of my many cases about consciousness. I'm saying cases because I used to be an attorney. It'd be another interview about consciousness. And it's a guy named Donald Hoffman. He's going to discuss his latest book, which is called The Case Against Reality, Why Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes. And Marie Mukzuki Mockett, who will join us to discuss her memoir, which is memoir, biography, autobiography, travelogue, picaresque novel. Excellent work. It's called American Harvest, God, Country, and Farming in the Heartland. So join us next week. Appreciate you being here and sticking with us during these times. So thanks a lot. See you next week on The Avid Reader.